This is Frank Coletta, and you are listening to Gangland Wire. And if you're ever in Vegas, take the Frank Coletta Casino Tour, 702-622-0850. Thank you.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, hello, all you wiretappers out there. You'll never believe this, but Aaron and I are talking to you from the 22nd floor of the Plaza Hotel in beautiful downtown Las Vegas. This, as you know, we went out to the Mob World Summit 2018, and we're out here, and we're picking up a few extra podcasts while we're out here, because we've got some people that I know have mob stories, and I would have to call them by phone, since they're not in Kansas City, but they're out here in the at the Mob World Summit, so get ready for a pretty interesting story from the mouth of one of the men who did it, which is that's what we like in an Aaron.
That's exactly what we love. that's kind of the moniker of our program.
It is. We try. Sometimes I just study up history and I talk about it, but we try to get it right out of the mouth of the men who did it.
And this is one of those moments.
It is. It's been quite a Mob World Summit so far. I saw you engaged with that guy that one of Gotti's friends, and their ongoing conflict with John A. Light.
Yeah, there's a whole other thing because of the post that we put up for the Mob Summit, and some guy came along saying, "Oh, what about this guy?" And he tagged somebody, and I'm like, I didn't even respond. I'm like, And then this guy from the Gotti movie, your friends with John Jr., comes in and he's speaking and. And it's like, well, do you know anything about these guys? And because it sounded like, was this the same people? I didn't even necessarily get that was the case from the discussion I had with them. But I mean, this has just been an incredible weekend, and it's only beginning because we're going to the Mob Museum tonight. We just got done hearing from J. Michael Nyota. Gary Jenkins,
yep.
Of course, he was one of the speakers, and the opening speaker, we got our selfie with Frank Coletta.
Yeah, look for the selfie. We'll have it up long before we get this podcast out. But
and, of course, then, you know, Larry Henry put things together, and there, I'm trying to think that I didn't, did I miss another speaker that we had?
You did. It was Frank Coletta, and it was Robert Raines from the Mob Museum in
Hot Springs, Arkansas.
Pretty interesting guy. He's written some screenplays, written a couple of books. He's wanting to create other mob museums. I'd like to see him do one in Kansas City, wouldn't you?
I think there's room for another mob museum in Kansas City. They've got a great mob history. Maybe we can get some of the mob people to kick in on it.
Some of that casino skim money,
some of the
grandchildren of Nick Savella and Tuffy and them
DeLuna.
Have, I'm sure.
Well, I asked Uncle Frank.
So. Yeah.
You know, I asked him to come
your
out
buddy. Aaron has one buddy that's in the mob.
He
might have been a bookmaker one time.
He may be a sports bookie
donate.
Now. He was the nephew of Tuffy DeLuna. He actually was riding up in the elevator when Bill Owsley told Tuffy how he was underneath Tuffy's bed. Like wherever Tuffy was at, he was there. And Frank, Uncle Frank, is a Frank Sigarusa. I hate to name him by actual name. Nephew of Tuffy DeLuna.
I hope that's okay with Frank. You may be in huge trouble here, Aaron.
I could be.
All right. Well, without further ado, let's introduce our guest. I first met Rick Andoretto. Correct, Rick?
Andoretto.
All right. I first met Rick at the first Mob Con in 2013, wasn't it, Rick?
I believe so.
And we had, well, Frank Coletta was there then, I believe. We had Frank Calabrese Jr., who we've had on the show. We had Andrew DiDonato, who we've had on the show. And Paul Scharf the kid murdering McHenry, who you know pretty well, and I met Rick.
I've known Paul since he was 10 years old.
That's why I thought you went way back with Paul. Yeah. And if you guys don't remember, Paul is the one. That's a heck of a story, isn't it, Rick?
Yes, it is.
Why don't you recount that, just a little bit of that? Well, I know you know something about it. Rick's a former law enforcement.
Yeah, let's get just his background.
Give us your background just a little bit.
I've been in law enforcement, retired now, but 22 years, mainly undercover work. And I retired as a chief of police of Lake Moore, Illinois, where Paul's father was killed, him and his bartender. And he was murdered by Larry Newman from the Hole in the Wall gang, affiliated with Tony Spilotro here in Vegas, and Frank Collada. But I knew Paul when he was young, 9, 10 years old, walking in to his dad's bar or restaurant. So I've known him since that long. And then when he wrote the book, Murder and McHenry, we reconnected and to tell a story here at MobCon about his dad's assassination and stuff like that.
And what's really interesting about that assassination, folks, if you don't remember listening to it, go back and listen to it. It was a two-part episode, I believe, of Murdering McHenry with Paul Scharff, S-C-H-A-R-F-F, if you want to Google it. He's got a website, too, with a lot of written blog pieces about the mob. But the story is really interesting. Paul gets a call from a friend of his whose daughter has read a true crime book written by our friend Denny Griffin and Frank Culotta. And Frank Culotta was one of Tony Spilotro's hole-in-the-wall gang. And in that book, Frank Culotta says one of his other fellow gang members, a guy named Larry Newman, also known as Lurch, killed a guy in the northern suburbs of Chicago. Actually, it's just north of Cook County. Is McHenry County, correct?
It's McHenry County, correct.
McHenry County, and he killed a guy just because he thought this guy disrespected his ex-wife.
Ex-wife.
Isn't that right?
Who was the waitress at the bar?
No, the ex-wife was just a customer.
Oh.
And but Ryan, Paul's father, she was getting belligerent one night, and he threw her out. So she ended up calling Larry out here in Vegas, and him and I believe Tommy Amato.
Yeah, right, Tommy Amato came back.
Drove back to McHenry to kill Ron because Ron disrespected Larry's ex-wife.
And where you got mixed up, the sister, it was wasn't a sister, but there was a waitress
that was there.
And he just killed them both.
This
guy was a cold dude, wasn't he?
Yeah. I walked in on this, the next morning when the police were called because the bartender, Pant, didn't show up to home after work. And there they were just sitting on a couch. And bullet holes in their head, and
he must have confronted him.
Well,
him sit down on the couch.
Right. It looks like he waited till the place closed. Ryan knew Larry, so Ryan probably didn't think nothing of it. Let's close up, and Larry got him in the back room on a couch, and there you go.
Ron, his father, Paul's father, Ron, probably thought he could talk some sense into the guy.
Probably.
And probably said, well, just sit down and talk about this.
Yeah.
We're speculating here, but, to get somebody sat on the couch like that, both of them.
Exactly.
No signs of struggle, right?
No struggle whatsoever.
See, interesting. He put him at ease. That guy was smart. He
no
put
money
him at
missing,
ease.
So I knew it wasn't a burglary.
Yeah.
It was just a hit and.
Rick, the main reason main thing we want to talk about is about your undercover investigation in a mob ran sports book and gambling joint.
Correct.
So who were you working for at the time? That was your entire career. This 4 years, the chief of police.
I had just left My previous years were with Cook County Sheriff with the Metropolitan Enforcement Group. It was an undercover narcotics group. And I had just left and got hired on with Island Lake Police Department, a small town, suburb of Chicago in Lake County, Illinois. And the chief, Ken Coates at the time, said to me, "You're not known anywhere. I want you to hit all these bars and hit this area and see if anything's going on." I said, "Okay, you know." So I just started hitting bars, and I walked in this bar called Tessie's Public House. It was a disco place back in the time, you know, in 1978. And I go in, sit down at the bar, have a drink, and I'm looking across the bar, and I recognized a guy who I knew was a dirty Cook County sheriff. And so I go, "Artie." And he looks at me. He goes, "Ricky." He remembered me. I knew Arnie through my dad. My dad was an associate in the Chicago Mafia and outfit. And so I went and sat next to him. I said, "What are you doing way up here?" And he goes, "Oh, I'm not a cop anymore. I'm working, for the outfit." I said, "What are you doing up here?" He goes, "Well, right next door, we're building a game room, for roulette and poker and everything." I said, "Really?" And he says, "Yeah, you want to see it?" I said, "Sure." So he takes me over there, and we got like 6 to 8 inch walls between the bar and the game room that he's building. Steel doors, two steel doors to get in it, so I said, "Well, I'm kind of out of work. I need, if you need help, I could help you. I know some carpentry skills, So I started helping Arnie build the room. And then he introduced me to Sally DeLorenis, who is now the head of the Chicago outfit. Back then, he was just a young Turk working for Black Joe Amato, who ran the Lake in McHenry County outfit. And so he introduces me to Sally D and Michael Posner, who was another part of the outfit. And Sally, asked me, "Who are you? Who am I?" And I said, "Well, I know Arnie. My dad, he used to, be in my dad's joint. My dad is Joe Adardetto. They called him Joe Shades." And Sally looked at me, and I said, "Yeah, and I know, Joey Lombardo and, a few of the other people." And I said, "I'm just looking for, a job." So he hires me as a bartender.
He didn't realize you had been a police officer, or did you talk about that?
No, of course, I was
in the Chicago area.
I had been undercover for so many years.
Oh, okay.
I knew, but I was always in narcotics.
Yeah.
Wait, you were so undercover, your dad didn't even know you were a
cop?
Oh,
no, this is,
But he didn't really know anything about you as an adult.
My father?
No, this Solly dude.
Oh, no. Not
okay,
as an adult.
All right.
No. And so they hired me as a bartender. Then as time went on and the game room was finished, they started getting some mob guys coming in to gamble at night, and then they made me a manager, so they gave me keys to the whole place. So after hours, we'd go in and take pictures and do what we had to do, try to get some intelligence. And then every time there was outfit members playing in the game, I had to bring drinks over back and forth between the bar and this room. So they just kind of like took me underneath their wing, and I knew everything. I knew where to keep they were keeping the paperwork for all this. And they always said, "If something ever happened, grab that briefcase." I said, "Sure, not a problem." So that went on for quite a six to eight months, but I had introduced more undercover cops in, because what we were trying to do is get more charges when there was at least two or three of us in the game room.
Yeah.
Two or three undercover cops.
So then when it all came down, then you said, okay, 8 months is long enough. They waited till the night that Black Joe Amato, who was one of the founding fathers of the Al Capone gang,
oh, really?
By the way.
I've heard that name. I didn't even know much about
it. Yeah, he's in the famous picture back that was taken back in 76.
Oh, yeah, the Last Supper
picture. The Last
Supper
picture. Yeah. He's sitting right there in front. Yeah, okay. Black Joe Amato. So they went.
Is he actually black?
Was he just kind of dark complexion? Well, how did he get his nickname?
Well, dark complexion, okay. But, okay. You know. I'm not sure.
Was he black hearted?
He
might have been black hearted.
Yeah, he was a tough guy. Nobody, you know, but he always stayed out of being arrested. You know,
he stayed out of the limelight. You hardly ever hear that name.
And so they, the state finally, took over the whole thing, and the feds were there, and so they picked this night, you know, that I knew for sure some big names were going to be there.
Yeah,
raid the place. So they raid it. You know, we all, I had open doors. For, you know, they came in from the back, the front, the side. There's so many cops. Is, kind
too
of funny.
Probably too many cops. Everybody wanted in on it, didn't they? I've been there.
And then, the place was packed. It's a bar next door. They raided that, too. And so when all the uniformed police were coming in, I pull out my badge from underneath my shirt around my neck, and everybody just kind of like, oh, my God. And I grabbed the briefcase and I go into the game room where Black Joe and Sally D and Nick Cirillo, who's one of the outfit guys, they looked at me, and Black Joe goes, puts his hand on my back. He says, for a young kid, you did a good job. And I said, thank you, Mr. Amato. I still showed him some respect because I knew who he was. And it was an interesting case, and they all pled guilty because they knew I had him.
Yeah.
You know? And
that
was
you weren't normally wearing your badge under your shirt every night.
No, only that night because I knew it was a raid.
Right.
I never carried an ID on me because at one point Sally and Mikey Posner got mad at me because I was always where they'd sit at a bar and whisper to each other, and I'd always be there wiping down the bar or doing glasses or something, and they got mad at me and fired me. And I said, wait a minute, man, I really need this job. And I had enough background knowledge that I said, well, listen, my godfather is Joe Fiorella. I said, I'm going to have to call him. I said, I need this job. They said, who's your godfather? I said, Joe Fiorella. Okay, well, just, try not to be near us all the time. I said, I'm sorry. What do I know? I said, I'm just trying to do my job. And I went, I'm like, oh, man, if I got fired, I would have, like, everybody would have been, mad at me. But I kept the job. Just using some background knowledge I had. I never met Joe Fiorella, but I knew at that time he was the Acunetta of the Chicago outfit.
Yeah.
So I bluffed my way.
I think he's the one that had the that Harry Alleman worked for and Rich Petrocelli, wasn't he?
Yep.
That Survivor Social Club.
Yep.
Taylor Street Crew, I believe.
He
got promoted on up. His sister was married, was Aleman's aunt, I think.
I believe so.
Yeah. So, he was a pretty important dude.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And they didn't want to go.
They didn't even want to go ask him about you.
What are they going to do? Ask him? I knew that. Yeah. I knew they wouldn't.
Yeah.
So I used it, bluffing, but
yeah,
I used
that's what we call a calculated risk.
Yeah, you know, either it worked or it didn't, and it worked. So that was
interesting.
Good, you know, then when they found out I was in a cover cop, they kind of looked at me.
Oh. What about that Cook County guy that you first met?
Well, Artie.
He was probably, he was a little bit weak after that. Hey, dude, you're the one that introduced him in.
After that, I never saw or heard of him. I went, oh, man, I don't think, because he's the one that got me in there.
I know.
You know?
I mean, that's probably the first guy they're going to whack.
Yeah, that's what I figured out.
You know, no one ever knows what happened to that guy.
I never could find him.
He probably went to Florida.
Never could find him.
6 feet under Florida, maybe.
Yeah, he stuck up for me from day one.
Interesting.
Yeah,
here's a question. So there, the police come in. There's all these cops there. They're raiding the place, right? So they're going to take it down. Why did you have to pull your badge out and reveal that you were working undercover? You could have simply been laying on the floor with everybody else.
I had been undercover.
It kept you undercover.
I had been undercover for a total of 9 years at that time.
And you wanted to come out.
I wanted to come out.
You wanted them to know.
I lost a marriage because of me being undercover. And not this.
We've got an audience here.
Well, I got two ex-wives. Yeah, I understand.
We are. You know, and I was, you know, bullshitting her.
Yeah.
Just like, which I didn't have to. She knew what I was doing, but I was acting just like I would on the street back home.
Yeah.
And I finally said, I had enough.
She's like, I thought I married a cop. You're a bartender.
Well, I had hair back then, too. And, you know, a beard and, you know, a loose perm like an afro.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and I did undercover work in motorcycle gangs, too, you know. So I had to look the part, you know. And if you ever been undercover, you ask any undercover cop that's done it for a while, you have to live that life.
Yeah.
You have to be that guy that you're trying to be.
Yeah.
And it's hard to go home and not be him anymore when you're him for 24, 36 hours at a time, mm-hmm. you know. And then you try and go home and be somebody you haven't been in for 3 days. It's really, it's hard.
Yeah, especially when if you do it full time, almost like that. Like we would go in a, you know, way I did, way I worked is we had a few undercovers that actually worked. We were undercover in that we didn't get introduced in, and we didn't really live that life other than on a small short time frame.
Correct.
Introduce somebody in and go do something, and you'd
then
go on back
out.
And just do surveillance and all that.
Yeah.
But you'd be hanging out in those bars all the time and. Yeah, I understand, you know, then you go back. I always used to marvel, you know, you act like you're some kind of a half-ass gangster when you're over in the city. You go back home, and then you got to go, you know, watch the Little League games or coach the Little League team, and you're this whole different life, whole different person almost than what even though I wasn't really actually, you know, making deals, hand-to-hand buys or making deals with anybody, but,
right.
you know, you're just living that life.
Yeah.
To fit in the joints and stuff. So
I mean, even my wife's friends, she was a high school teacher, they know, you know, who I was, what I was doing. They just figured I was a bartender. I used to use that a lot as a cover.
Yeah,
you know?
That'd be a good one, easy one.
And I could always bop from joint to joint and bartend and work into whatever crowd, you know.
Yeah.
And this one night, I met my wife and her girlfriends, and I forgot I had my backup, a little snub 38 I stuck in my crack.
Mm-hmm.
And she reached to touch me back there as we were dancing, and I had to grab her hand. And she went, "What is that?" I said, "Oh, just a knife, just in case something happened." You know, I was kind of like, "Uh-oh," you know. Barb, if she says something, you got to tell her, don't say anything, you know. But when it all came out and that I was actually a cop for all these years, even our friends, "You've been a cop for 10 years? You gotta be kidding me." "No, I'm not kidding you."
"Can you fix this ticket for me?"
"You're the best bartender."
That's the next question. "Hey, I got a ticket.
Yeah.
Do you think this is right?" How many times you heard that one?
You know, a lot, and I don't know traffic law. And, that wasn't part of me. I think I was in uniform 1 year, other than when I was in uniform as chief of police.
Yeah.
You know, and otherwise, I couldn't tell you about a traffic stop. I don't know.
I think I wrote about five the first couple years I was on.
It was a traffic stop where I got hurt real bad. You know, three guys got me on the side of the street, you know, on the side of the road. And
did you have to turn in the money that you made bartending because they were paying you?
That's
your
a good question.
No, everybody asked me that. And no, I did not.
You got the tips, you got the hourly.
I got the tips,
keep
I got
that
the
money
hourly.
Too. Plus your salary.
Plus my salary.
That's a pretty good gig.
Hey, I loved it for 10 years.
No wonder you're undercover for so long. You had a house payment to make, right?
Yeah, I was making good tip
money.
Better
than off-duty job, wasn't it? Off-duty, on-duty job.
Yeah. After a while.
It was.
I cannot give up this bartending job.
We used to get in trouble for those off-duty, on-duty jobs.
Well, you know, I think one captain asked me something about being... Are you keeping track of your money? And I just kind of looked at him, and I looked at my LT, and I went, he is. And I pointed to my lieutenant, yeah. I don't know nothing about it. You know, whatever he says.
Yeah, interesting. So when you came out, you didn't go back to patrol. Did they just put you in the detective unit, or did you work
right
like administrative narcotics or something?
Yeah, narcotics, I ran an undercover team. I never went back undercover.
Okay.
I just ran the team. And then...
Wait, when you say you ran a team, you were...
I was a lieutenant.
And then they were all undercover?
Right. So, yeah, it's called a MEG unit, Metropolitan Enforcement Group. So you have cops from all different departments, county and state, and then all the city departments. So you have jurisdiction no matter where you go. Well, I always had a Fed with you, mm-hmm. and a state cop, a county, a couple county, different county cops on the team, and then different municipality, local cops.
And you did that because you were crossing municipal boundaries and you needed to keep
I remember one case, we started at 51st in Wentworth, south side of Chicago, and ended up 100 miles north to the Wisconsin Illinois state line, and that's where we ended up making the bust. But it traveled that far, and we had jurisdiction every place we went with this one case, because the MEG unit.
Yeah.
So you always had jurisdiction no matter where we went.
Now, so if the guys you busted made it to Wisconsin, they would have got away?
Because
you hadn't...
No, because...
Bonnie and Clyde crossing state lines.
Well, what we did do, because we weren't sure what was going to happen there, so we contacted...
That's
Wisconsin.
Why you had the Fed with you, too.
Yeah, we had the Fed with us, but he wanted to contact Wisconsin State just in case he did go over the border, so we had some local jurisdiction up in another state. But we always had a Fed with us too. But yeah, they don't wanna step on toes unless they really have to.
Yeah.
You know, that would have stepped on Wisconsin's toes.
Well, you're kind of in the dynamic of these things going down at the time, and you can't be like, well, hold on a minute.
Yeah, we have to wait half an hour.
So we're about to go across the border, but you need to hold on a second.
No,
I didn't see that.
No, never did that. We never held on. We just went ahead and did it if we couldn't, wait.
Yeah,
you know,
take them down.
And then wait for them to show up. Okay, you're here. Good. You're coming with us. Here's what we did. Yeah. You know.
Sorry.
And the problem is, there's a one time, so we were with one MEG unit, but there's, different counties had some of their own MEG units. And I've told my wife this story. You're working 3 months undercover and trying to build a case, and when it comes time to make the bust, they're cops too. Everybody you've been working and everybody they've been working, we were all cops. Didn't know we were all cops. Both sides.
No.
Everybody's taking out badges and guns on both sides.
I've heard of that. I never
ran
into it.
You got to be kidding
me.
So you just took down like another county's department.
Yeah.
And they thought they were taking you down.
Yep.
But yeah, I like how he said we took out badges and guns.
Oh yeah,
said badges first.
Well, every stand up with a badge in one hand, gun in the other. Uh oh.
You know.
Who's the boss here? Yeah.
I think I saw that on a movie.
Well, it happens all the time.
California.
Every time I see it in a movie, I look at my wife and I say, did I tell you the story about when I...
You mean that happened more than once?
Oh, well, after that, we started hearing other stories from other departments.
Yeah.
And like, oh, that happened to us too, you know? So it happens probably more than people think.
Well, that says something about both of your units' cover stories.
Exactly.
And license numbers and all that, because first thing you do, you start, you know, writing down license numbers and getting names and trying to identify who
but
people really are.
All the cars that we drove were confiscated cars, you know. And we had our radios, you know, undercover radios underneath our seats and stuff. But, you know, I'd have a doper in, you know, I drove a Trans Am. Sometimes he'd be sitting in the passenger seat and we'd do the deal, you know, and everything's being recorded in the car. And he gets out and I take off and the arrest team comes in and boom, you know. But our cars were all confiscated drug cars anyway.
Yeah.
And then the plates on them would trace back to the phony name that
phony name, you know, phony, you know.
Sounds like a Jerry Seinfeld, like, you know, cops in cars getting cocaine. Be a great series.
Yeah, it would.
Yeah. But it was the Sally D and the Posner and Black Joe Amato case that that was probably one of my last case undercover cases.
Yeah. It was a nice way to go out undercover, man.
Well, I said, where else from, you know, he's got, you know, all these mafia outfit guys, you know, and I had Black Joe Amato pat me on the back for a job well done. And it was the only conviction he ever had. He pled guilty. You know, he's always, you know, stayed out of the limelight. And he goes, you got me. I'm just going to plead guilty. You know, I said, well, whatever you say, Mr. Amato.
You
know?
You guys did state charges, it sounds like.
Yeah.
When the feds involved.
Well, yeah, but on Posner, he was on federal probation.
Oh, yeah.
So we had to go through this organized strike force for testimony and probation hearings on him. We pulled Sally D's, all their liquor licenses from the city. Pulled all that, so they had to close up all their businesses.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. Yeah, they shut down a restaurant and bar. Then Sally owned a liquor store down the street. They shut that down for a while because I would go there sometimes and bring liquor to the restaurant down the street. And in Illinois, you couldn't do that.
That's kind of a no-no, if I remember right.
Yeah,
in liquor laws, you can't take it from retail establishment and then go out and sell it.
You have to go.
See, the Posners, they owned the Roman House in Wheeling, Lincolnshire, Illinois area. And it was a strip joint, but they couldn't serve liquor or champagne or anything. Well, I was always delivering liquor and champagne to the Roman House from the liquor store and the restaurant, you know, where they got their liquor deliveries.
Mm-hmm.
I'd load up my van and I'd always once a week take it to the Roman House. And a couple times I'd throw in, you know, I'd make a phone call. Hey, I'm going to the Roman House. I'd pick up another cop and, you know, help me deliver it so he could see the, you know, the operation.
Yeah.
And so there's always justification, not just my word against, you know, against theirs.
Yeah, I was going to say, wouldn't you have to? How would you kind of document these events other than a kind of a written statement or photography?
So lately, you hear about Comey.
Yeah, the contemporaneous notes.
All the notes.
Yeah.
Well, back then, that's what it was.
Yeah.
When I got done working, where I went home to, or you know. I'd go through legal pads left and right because you're writing everything down. That's how it used to be. That tape recorders or, you know, on a phone now. Or
I hope you had good handwriting. Otherwise, oh, yeah. Some poor stenographer was going, oh, God, I hate this guy. They used to hate me.
Yeah. My handwriting's pretty good. But that's, you know, every time I hear about the Kobe memos, that's how we used to do it.
Yeah.
Right.
You know?
Interesting.
So.
All right, 9 years. I mean, I think it's kind of interesting in that, you know, so you're in that last kind of that last one we talked about at the beginning, and it was 6-8 months on that particular. And I think, you know, as opposed to kind of going in where, like Gary would say, we'd kind of go in on a short and grab somebody. You'd kind of work undercover, and it wouldn't be long-term like you
right,
were doing.
Yeah. Very well, few people work long cover.
Yeah, but you would do that not because you're trying to work your way up to the Black Joe Amatos. You weren't trying to get those lower level guys.
Oh no, yeah, but
I mean, you would sweep those guys up too. But
sure.
You were trying to kind of work your way up the food chain to the higher level.
Right. When
guys.
I came across Black Joe Amato, and then we had Nick Cirillo one night, and another guy. I want to say Jimmy Morelli. Or something like that. I can't remember for sure. When I started seeing these guys, you know, the hitmen and you know, bosses show up, we knew we had something, not just a little mom and pop dime gambling thing. You know, we knew we had something going on. And so we just, you know, kept trying to work up and work up. That's, you know, that's the case even at a buy bust in narcotics. You buy bus, boom, right, who you getting it from? And, you know, so you always try to work up.
Yeah.
Did they ever try to get you to do anything that would be of such an illegal nature that
it'd compromise your position?
In Solid D?
Yeah.
No.
Never, okay.
No. Nope. The only thing that came close was one day I came to work, and the night before, and this is in the family. This came out in the Family Secrets case with Frank Calabresi Jr. Yeah. But one night, I go into work, and Sally sends me into the game room. He says, "Clean it up. We had a little problem last night." And they had a guy in there that owed the money, beat the hell out of him. Blood everywhere, splattered all over the walls. Just beat the hell out of this guy. I can't remember his name, but it came out who it was in the Family Secrets book trial.
Oh, really?
And as soon as it came out, I went,
"Yeah,
I know exactly what you're talking about, so I had to clean it up." You know?
Was it Junior, was it Nick, or was it Senior? You don't know in terms of maybe who beat the guy up.
Oh, I know it was Sally and probably B.J. Williams Jehoda.
Jehoda, yeah.
I'm not sure. And Sally had another guy, right-hand guy, and I can't remember his name. But it was definitely Sally involved in it, you know.
He says a red-headed guy, and I always remember when we had that conversation when they were talking about the red-headed girl.
Curly-headed girl.
Curly-headed girl.
Yeah.
I think because they would use different descriptors of people they were talking about. And I'm like, sometimes when we have these interviews and we'll kind of cross conversational paths between different people.
Sure.
Like, oh, well, didn't Frank Culotta mention something about that?
Yeah, it was a curly-headed girl. That was in that, they were referring to some bookmaker or something in code. And they had a bug in the prison waiting room.
Yeah, Frank Calabrese.
Frank would come back in and visit with his dad, or then they had those two policemen, or one policeman and some other guy. Kind of kept Twan and the other guy.
Yeah,
I can't remember their names, and they were bugging them. And Frank Senior was giving these guys orders about doing this and doing that and contacting what. And they said something about what about the curly headed girl? You know, you talked about sitting close to them or standing close to them. A lot it'd be really hard to understand what they were talking about unless you really you had some context. But sometimes you can pick up something and then tell it to somebody else, and they'll say, "Oh yeah."
Yeah,
I get that.
And
because this happened.
I in my notes, you know, I kept really good notes. And then, so that when the higher ups, you know, stated, yeah. Right here, you wrote down, were you sure they said this or could it have been this? And I said, well, pretty sure it's really close to what I wrote.
Yeah.
You know, now don't try and change what you want me to hear. This is what I heard.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm not going off on your little thing when it did happen. You know, let's not go that way.
I always, I understand.
Yeah. Like, no. We're not going there.
They're just really kind of trying to coach you to get what they want.
Right. Now, these are my notes. This is what I did. Not this, it's not in my handwriting. Yeah, I would never let that happen. So.
What happened to those notes?
Barbie?
What happened to those notes?
Oh, still in the police file.
Oh, that would make a great book.
I know. I have quite a few police reports that I have that would make a good book. But never thought about doing it.
It's a lot of work, trust me. It is
a lot of work.
Well,
everybody talked to you like you and Paul.
Oh, yeah.
It's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work.
Cindy, you ever hear Cindy Minch from Wisconsin? She does a lot of interviews.
I think so.
Yeah. She even says, well, I'll help you write it if you want, but it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know about you, but Gary had a little bit of help on his book, you know, from Nick Savella.
I just took the whole wiretap and stuck it in there. And then explained it.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to write that whole thing.
Yeah.
It's too much work. I've written one other book that I read the whole thing, and it wasn't anything about the mob, and it is a lot of work. Plus, and I probably paid $600-$700 out to an editor and what they call beta readers. And pay people to just, that's their job, is to read your book and then give you good feedback.
Right.
And just for self-publishing.
Then I got to self-publish, and then that means that all the advertising, all the marketing, and any copy I sell is what I go out and sell, like programs like this. It's a tough world.
Publishing, that's what I'm told.
Selling books, it's hard.
I look at it, it's been this long now, but where start now?
Unless you're just really driven to do it.
Yeah.
It's not worth it to me.
Well, but some of the stuff, I mean, like your experiences are experiences that other people haven't had. And, I mean, it's very, I really appreciate you sitting down with us and talking, because these are some of the best stories from the mouth of the men that did it. And a lot of times there's that wall, that code of silence that they talk about with the mob. But that code of silence really falls both ways, because it's not traditionally that the cops come forward and, if you will, and talk about the work that they've done. And so getting the opportunity to sit down with somebody like you who spent 22 years and then 9 undercover, that's crazy.
Well, you beat that Jimmy from New England.
Yeah.
So I was telling, he was asking me questions last night. I said, you know, here's the thing to remember. You can hear all these stories and see all these movies. I said, but what you're going to hear here at Mob World is from Gary, from Ron Fino, and what I'm telling you, it's stuff that we lived and we did.
Yeah.
It's the truth.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a fictional activity, you know, in somebody's mind. We went through this. We did this, you know.
All right. You actually cleaned up that beat down.
Yeah. And he and Jimmy, you know, he just kind of like, oh my God, you know. And I said, well, yeah. You know, I mean, so we're not here, you know, to get pats on the back. We're here to let you know this is how it really
was.
You know, this is what we did. This is actually what happened.
That's what I love working with Gary about, is because you don't necessarily see people doing that, is maybe more so now in the years that we've been doing this. But, you know, you didn't necessarily find a lot of police officers coming forward and speaking about their experiences.
Well, most of them can't remember.
Yeah. Or they don't want to.
I talked to friends of mine.
That's not me. I have a great, I remember
you
stuff.
You got a good memory. But
I remember stuff. My older brother looks at me and says, how can you remember that? You were 5 years old. I said, I don't know.
I just, I'm telling you, I was with Dad, and this is what, yeah. You know, I mean, I remember that kind of, you know.
I got a guy I worked with, and I'll mention something that we did, and he'll go, I don't remember that.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
Yeah.
So here's the kind of a question, then. You come out from being undercover, mm-hmm. and you don't retire immediately, do you?
Oh, no.
You stay in.
Right.
What did your dad say? I mean,
My dad passed away in 1977.
Oh. When did you first join the force?
Well, no. I had been a cop. I started police work when I was in college. I was majored in criminology mm-hmm. at Indiana State University, Terre Haute, Indiana. And I went to do my internship with the Terre Haute Police Department. And they put me right on undercover on campus. So I had been undercover by all of my end of sophomore, all of junior and senior year on campus. And that's how I started police work. Yeah.
And once you got a taste of that undercover, you were like Gary with that intelligence unit.
Well, it takes a special...
Everybody can't do it. Yeah, I know.
To do undercover work. You know, some people, I can do that.
No. No, they can't. It's hard.
Yeah.
Well, having sounds like a photographic memory, which would really be important because I think these guys would kind of try to trip you up.
Well, sure.
You're at the bar. You're wiping down the bar by them. They're like, hey, go the other way.
Yeah.
You know, go down there. But you're like, you know, I'm washing the glasses now. And. You know, and they,
it's not my fault. They sat right where the sink was.
Right.
You know, I always make sure I had dirty glasses in case they sat right there and I start cleaning glasses. But
they wouldn't try to kind of, you know, trip you up. Once the guy vouched for you, everyone was like, well, he's good to go.
No, I had the right knowledge of the outfit mm-hmm. because I grew up in it with my dad. I personally met Tony Accardo, Jack Cerrone, Joey Iupa, Tony Spilatro, Frank Swice. They used to all be at my dad's restaurant. Mm-hmm. And I've been cooking, you know, since I was 11, 12 years old at my dad's place. So, you know, I grew up in the restaurant business, and I knew these people, actually knew them. So I had enough bullshit, you know, when I got stuck, the used, and it works. It worked.
You bluff your way out.
I bluffed my way out
of it. And then you'd remember the bluff.
Yeah.
Well, and you, I mean, growing up around those folks, you must have known that they were not just, you know, milk delivery men.
Oh, no, I knew who they were. My dad introduced me. You know, and he says, now, you have to understand who these guys are. I go, okay, Dad, I understand. Don't worry about it.
And then you said, Dad, I'm going to college for criminal justice.
That I had to talk to him about. I had to ask. I said, I want to be a cop. I said, but I'm going to be in narcotics. He goes, okay, good. Narcotics, don't worry about it. If you ever have a problem, you know, we'll handle it. He goes, but don't worry about it. But the outfit happened after my dad passed away, so I didn't have to approach him.
Didn't have to warn him about what might happen. Yeah,
you know, permission or anything. Yeah, you know, he was passed away, so I just did what I did. You know, and if I got any, my older brother got some feedback on it. I had sent a couple of state cops, Leo DeGrosso and Joe Sanasir, to his place of employment to cover him a few nights. He worked at a place called Tom Patton's Rib Palace, and Tommy Patton was actually Tommy Allegretti, and Allegretti was part of the family, so my brother got some feedback, but I sent a couple of cops just to hang out there and cover his butt just in case. Yeah. The good old days.
All right, so, I think we've covered this waterfront, Rick. I really appreciate you doing this,
and
I'll let you know when we get this. I got to edit it, and I got a bunch of stuff still in the can. I got four episodes on Harry Ailman, with that kid from Chicago Outfit News Articles, mm-hmm. and Mike Byrne.
We might have to make it a Chicago month.
Well, I got enough to make two Chicago months now, I think, because I got another one with him. I don't remember what it was about, so we'll probably have a Ben Ellickson will be happy, won't he?
Right.
We got this guy in Chicago who sent us a Chicago City flag.
Okay.
Ben Ellickson, so
we hung it up in the studio.
Yeah. Well, and then so he we got it around in the studio.
He was the same guy that found the bottle.
Found a bottle from the Standard Brewing Company. This guy, Rick, I digress on our podcast, but let me tell you this one. This guy, he runs a backhoe, kind of a digging machine, and he put up he took his iPhone and shot a video of him doing this. He's digging in a place where there's some old bottles from the Standard Brewing Company, which is back in the 20s, 30s. And so he showed how he'd turn up on these bottles, and he'd take this huge big shovel with his machine and gently pick up that bottle and move it over and dump it out and not break it. So he sent me one of them. He found more than one. And so he sent us one of them for the studio.
Did he post that on Facebook?
Yeah, he did.
I saw that.
All right.
I saw that. That's interesting.
He's a fun guy. He's a good guy.
Yeah. No, I mean, there's so many great stories out of Chicago. And
oh, God.
Oh, sure.
Just the... it's like it's its own version of New York.
Yeah, it is.
It's like I was telling Jimmy for New England last night. Here's Ken Edo back in 1983. Gets a couple bullets in the back of the head.
Yeah.
And lives to tell about it. And becomes an informant. Now you don't expect that. The hit guys, boom boom. Figure all right, they're done, over with, and the guy lives. You can't make that kind of stuff up.
No, you can't.
What's amazing about that story, and it kind of ties back into like a conversation we had, I want to say, with Frank Culotta, where these guys, what's the deal with loading your own rounds? They would be like, well, we half load. And I guess that's what happened with Ken Edo, is these guys loaded their own rounds. Yeah. It's like half loads. And when they shot
keep the sound down.
Yeah, the bullets didn't penetrate.
Keep the sound down, and then no trace of them buying ammo.
Yeah, and might load your own ammo too.
So
yeah.
If you load your own ammo,
that I can understand.
Yeah.
Like they trace it back to where they bought the ammo.
Right.
But it's a gunshot.
Yeah,
they're not.
Yeah, but if you're not, I worked with a guy that used to load his own ammo. Then there's an art to it. So if you don't know how to do it the right way, you're gonna get the half shot.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then you end up dead yourself,
exactly.
Like the two guys who tried to kill Ken Edo. I mean, it's a rough business.
Oh, yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
I mean, and to be a guy that's undercover, I mean, you had to know that these guys, if they found out, you would just be gone.
I smoke Winston 100s.
Mm-hmm. Non-filtered.
No, but I had... In certain situations, you couldn't have a gun on you.
Right. Yeah.
But they never checked your cigarette pack. And I had a little two-shot...
No, Derringer.
That fit in.
Inside a cigarette.
And I always had a little gun just in case.
Just in case.
And that's why I've always smoked the 100. I could always fit that little gun in there.
Yeah. And people are trying to bum a cigarette, you're like, I'm sorry, I'm out.
Well, you got a full pack, dude.
I've only got two left. I can't give you one.
It was me, another guy, and Vicky, a girl, went in to do a buy, and they patted us down left and right.
Yeah.
Checking everything, this was a tough one, but I had that little Derringer just in case.
And they didn't look inside.
I didn't look inside, but at least we knew we had a gun.
Yeah, at least one gun. Yeah,
we got one gun.
These are the tricks that you don't get when you have Google search stuff.
No, that's true. That's true.
You don't hear about that.
You gotta listen to the podcast to get those tricks. All right.
I'm not a smoker, but I might start carrying a pack of cigarettes.
Yeah. You don't need to carry a gun, Aaron.
Okay.
do my public service announcement. Yeah. We'll get out here. If you have a friend or relative with a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, folks, you need to get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available for purchase on Amazon. And then, of course, after you've watched that, it's just the beginning, the tip of the iceberg of Gary Jenkins' stories, including the Leaving Vegas book that he just wrote. How mob domination... No, what is it? Leaving Vegas, how FBI wiretaps into mob domination.
I'll have it like hell there.
That's usually his line. I just say... You got to get his book, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
And that's a great read, and then you're going to want to get the Kindle, because the Kindle actually has hyperlinks to the audio that is the words from the mouth of the men that did it. And you're going to want to listen to that, and you're going to want to know more. And there is more to know, because Gary's got an app. It's the Kansas City Mob Tour app. For $1.99, you can take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. We might have to add a few more because he's got some addresses there that he mentioned.
Well, we'd have to go to Chicago. Chicago tour.
You want to go to Chicago, though.
And, I'm thinking about it.
And, folks, if that's not enough, then you want to go and share and subscribe and support the Gangland Wire podcast. It's available on iTunes for free, almost 200 episodes. By the time you hear this, probably over 200 episodes. Yeah.
All right. Thanks a lot, Rick. Thanks
Thank
for being
you.
Here.
Thank you.
Say goodnight, Aaron.
Good night, Aaron.
Good night, everybody.
Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.